Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hulfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris Effects products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with Oscar winner Claire Simpson, ACE, and Sam Restivo about editing Ridley Scott's Napoleon. Claire won an Oscar, a BAFTA, and an Ace Eddie for editing Platoon. She won a BAFTA and was nominated for an Oscar and an Ace Eddie for The Constant Gardener. Other films include Nine, Wall Street, and The Last Duel. Sam Restivo has been an additional editor on several films, including The Greatest Showman, The Last Duel, and House of Gucci. He was also an additional editor on the TV series Raised by Wolves. Before I hop into our discussion with Claire and Sam, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Claire Simpson, ACE, and Sam Restivo discuss editing Ridley Scott's Napoleon. Thank you so much for joining me. Filming took place mostly in England. Did you edit near the production, and why or why not?
We did, yes. We edited in England while they were shooting, and then we moved to Malta for the Malta locations. Then we did our director's cut in France, in the south of France, where Ridley has his home, and finished in London with the dubbing and visual effects.
Is there a reason why either of you like to be close to production? Is there a value in that to you?
I think it's very valuable. I think it's important that we have access to the members of the production team. We have a very close relationship with all the heads of department and a lot of the technical crew. It's very much a family, and we can prevail on them and in the evening or at weekends. And that closeness, I think, is very important. Plus, it's important to have Ridley close at hand for several reasons. I mean, if we have any fear of not understanding something or wondering about shots that he has done, which we don't quite know where they belong, or all kinds of questions, we always have him at weekends. He will always come to the end of a day if we ask him to, so we can show him cut scenes. We keep right up to camera so he can see stuff that he shot a day before, you know, already assembled. So it's helpful for him, and it's really helpful for us because it helps us get the work done quickly and efficiently.
Yeah, we can solve problems way faster that way. Because whenever editorial says something, it's like, oh, wait, we're not sure you can see this, or this seems dark, or something like that. Being close enough that any of these department heads, any other members that it's pertinent to, can actually just come to see it. And Ridley himself, and we could just get through it way faster that way.
I don't think the script was based on a book, just general Napoleon's history. Did either of you do any research?
Well, I did reading. I did a lot of music research from the period. A lot of those songs you hear in the film are from the period. They're revolutionary songs. The Edith Piaf song at the beginning of the film is from the revolution itself. And this also the song that they use in the theatre piece, where they do that spoof of Marie Antoinette's head getting cut off. That's also a song from the revolution. So, yes, I did a fair amount of research, but it wasn't based on any one particular book.
And it sounds like very music-driven.
Oh, yeah. Yes. The music was a big... We even had a music supervisor on during prep, actually, who gave us access to a whole volume of different options. Her name is Kathleen Wallfish, and she did a fantastic job for us. She found that specific Edith Piaf recording and then a variety of the other things. It really helped us understand what the tone was going to be when we started cutting the film.
I love the sound design in the opening credits. How much do you try to build out sound design in your picture cut? And does the sound change the picture?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly for battles, it's really difficult with production sound to cut a battle sequence and make it presentational. You've really got to have a sound team or even our assistants. And Sam is very good at tutoring our assistants with sound design. It's very important, I think, for assistants to understand how important it is to fill out a scene and to think creatively about how to fill it out sound-wise.
So with the opening specifically, Ridley was really enamored with the guillotine sound idea. And so we were using that on those cuts to blacks for the title cards and stuff. It developed this kind of sense of threat that was coming for that scene. And there was always an idea towards sound in every sequences in the movie to be like, what emotion are we really playing here at this very moment? So from the beginning, and knowing that this was such a giant film with once we get to action stuff, that we had the members of sound editorial, one or two of them come on early, supervised by Oliver Tarney and James Harrison. And that, it was a team effort to get the design of the sound going as soon as we could.
And did they give you some kind of a toolkit or sound effect library to start building from, or did you just use whatever you had?
It was a little bit of both, to be honest. We, as editors, have developed a sound library that we have for the quick and dirty stuff, but then there would be specific cannonball type sounds that we would really impress upon the sound editorial team to give us some options for things like that, and the muskets. So it was a combination of the both.
Temperatures of performance, especially with Joachim, did he give you a lot of options of differences in temperature, or was he pretty much locked in on one temperature?
Oh, no, he gave us a variety. He would always do a straight performance, and then, he would do variations, and they would get more extreme the more takes he had. He was wonderful, actually. He also was very cognizant of giving us the continuity of those performances, through the various takes. He's a true professional. He really understands what we need editorially.
And as an actor, he's clearly staying in the moment for absolutely everything and trying to make it as real and personal and emotional as it can be for him in the moment, which makes it exciting for us to see something that's kind of a surprise each time out. And Ridley encourages the actors to do that so that it stays fresh. That's why he doesn't really like to rehearse a whole lot. He wants to see how it can just live in the moment with these actors. And Joaquin is best of the best right there.
What were some of the guiding principles when you've got a warmer performance and cooler and more extreme and less extreme? What was guiding you in choosing which temperature to use, if you can think of an example?
We don't always arrive at that final choice. We work at it. We work at various options. We do multiple cuts until we really hit on the kind of core theme of the movie. Editing is the final rewrite in a way. So you don't just arrive at it immediately. It's really a question of elimination, and just trying different things. From my point of view, I like to go for the most extreme and then I pull it back. But it's important for me to be able to explore how far I can take a scene before it just becomes silly. So it's trial and error.
Yeah, we're always looking for the most authentic moments. Joaquin will play a bunch of different emotions, and same for Vanessa as well. And we would go for the extreme stuff because that's the most interesting and compelling to us, but then pull it back when there was really a question of, well, do you believe this right now? What emotion is reading the most truthful in the moment? That was the guiding light for us in that case.
Claire pointed out that the choice that you make early might not be the final choice, obviously. Can you think of a temperature choice that you made that changed once you saw it in context or in the arc of the character?
Claire did the scene where Napoleon and Josephine have an argument overnight, and the performers played it in a lot of different ways, and in like some very extreme ways and then some moderate ways. And we looked at the scenes kind of in both ways. And Ridley was confident about how this was going to work, that it was ultimately going to be like a couple's argument, the kind of argument that lasts all night. There were times where initially it was too dramatic, per se, and not that we wanted to make it funny or anything, but it helped to soften that a little bit, and it made Josephine's performance really strong when it was just like her choice of readings on some of the lines was very deliberate and it was very strong, and it made for a fantastic toe-to-toe kind of performance to go up against Napoleon.
There's a lot of voiceover, reading of letters primarily. How did that evolve over the course of the edit, either the voiceover itself or the images that accompanied it?
The letters were actually in the script, not all of them. We did elaborate on some of the letters. Napoleon was a prodigious letter writer, and he wrote to Josephine many, many times. She did not write very much. After they divorced, she in fact wrote more. So a lot of the letters are taken from original source. It was always intended. We in fact did a cut without the letters just to see if we really needed them. Joaquin, during the shoot, did record the letters. So we had his letters to work with. And then we started to introduce Josephine's letters. That was more of an afterthought. But I think it works quite well because she dies about three quarters into the film. It does keep her still present.
Did either one of them record multiple times, or was it really just a single performance of the letters that you got?
Oh, it was a lot. Because we were evolving what the idea in those moments were going to be. So obviously with Josephine, there really aren't many sources of her letters back to him. So we were having to kind of create an amalgam of what she actually said to kind of like head toward the emotion we were going for in that moment. The choice to do a letter of hers after her death was a very controversial one for us to go to. It's like, well, it doesn't logically make sense, but this is how we make the hauntingness of it work, and it makes for such an interesting thing to end the film on, his constant hearing of her in his head. It was a trial and error thing with that too, but the actors were very kind to record multiple times for us and follow Ridley's lead of how the letters were going to evolve for the film.
I want to talk about sound design again a little bit. I love the sound design in the big battle on the frozen lake.
To be perfectly honest, a lot of it was cut MOS because you couldn't use the sound. I have different ways of approaching a scene. Sometimes I just cut a scene visually and then fit sound afterwards. Or I'll do the reverse sometimes. Sometimes I'll just take a dialogue scene and just cut the dialogue sound, and then I'll fit the picture. It's a way of me getting into a scene. I like to develop the rhythm sometimes, and that's why I'll cut the track to establish a rhythm and then lay the picture over it. Those scenes, you could not use the production track at all. Obviously, where there's any kind of conversation, we would use the production. We were very fortunate because we did have working concurrent with us our sound team, who really helped us out a lot in making it much more presentational. bringing on their wealth of library sounds. And then, you know, when the main team came on, they would develop more of a kind of design element and record a lot of stuff, you know, like whistling sounds of the cannons and stuff, things like that, to give it detail, but also be much more succinct about what sounds you play at any one moment. If you were in the field, what would you hear flying overhead? But that sort of came a little bit later. And then we experimented a lot in the mix as well. We did many temp dubs to try and establish what kind of sound design we were going for. Of course, we're also very dependent on visual effects because we didn't have the visual effects at that point. So, of course, as soon as the visual effects start to come in, then you have to elaborate the soundtrack to accommodate. The dub, it becomes a very organic thing as you're getting more and more material. And also the scale, because you don't know necessarily what the scale is. Of course, we have these huge wide shots, but they haven't been filled in. And so once you start filling in those wide shots and you realize that there's many thousands of troops there marching, you have to obviously create a sound for that.
We were definitely wanting all of the battles to have their own feel to it, their own sound. And with Austerlitz, knowing that we had the underwater stuff, it's going to be a low end sound. Like it's a really intense, it's the most intense battle we have in the film. So we leaned into that. And there are so many elements. We have voiceover at the very beginning, and then there's the practical, like the muskets firing, and then the cannons, and then the music, which thing is going to drive the most. And mm-hmm. I think in the mix, we kind of leaned a little bit more toward the music in a lot of those cases, because it highlighted the tragedy of this thing. Even though Napoleon's this military genius, it's at a massive loss of life. And we used the underwater sound of things to kind of drive a lot of the deep sound design for the end of that sequence specifically.
Claire mentioned the VFX idea of having a wide shot that's maybe not filled in. How much do you have to just use your imagination to go, it's a crappy looking shot right now, but I know there's going to be 10,000 troops on there, so I need to hold it a little longer.
There's no reason not to trust Ridley Scott with battle scenes. So like we know, oh, there's going to be thousands of people in these shots. And our VFX supervisor, Charlie Henley, is one of the best. And we had also Ridley's storyboards that he would draw for us to give us just, you know, even a written approximation of what it's going to ultimately look like. And we knew there would be more people. That's what it ultimately came down to, that the shots were going to work eventually. So we just had to use our imagination in the moment.
And they did also, they shot in some of the strangest locations for the one scene, a location where Napoleon's on the hillside looking down on this great white expanse, which becomes the frozen lake. Well, the frozen lake was part of a disused airfield. There was no snow on it, no ice. It was just runways. The first assembly looks really strange. And in fact, Joaquin couldn't quite grasp the whole idea of this ice because he couldn't see it. He would say to Ridley, why am I giving these orders? I don't quite get it. What am I doing? It was in fact only when he saw the film that he thought, oh, okay, Ridley, now I get it. We know Ridley so well, so it's a little bit more easy for us to accept his whole world vision, as it were.
When Bonaparte and Josephine are discussing their imminent divorce in a scene, just the two of them, talk to me about the decision of deciding when to be on the person talking and when to be on a reaction.
For me, a lot of it is intuition, and a lot of the way I cut is purely intuitive. I just feel my way through the drama, as it were. Because sometimes it's stronger if you're on the person that's just listening, maybe not even reacting, but just listening. For me, it's totally intuitive. I don't know about you, Sam.
It's the same. And I would say we have two actors here with Joaquin and Vanessa who are so expressive. And the thing that's most interesting to me as an editor is I love watching people when they're not saying anything, even if they're not emoting, as editing creates these emotions through the cut. Vanessa is just magic when she's just watching him there. And he's you know, drooling on about, I do everything for the people of France and all of that stuff. Being on her and watching her like slowly, you know, realize that the end is about to happen is the thing that just highlights the drama. Like you just get such a clear picture on this character, even when she's not saying anything.
I have a challenge for you, and that is I read a really interesting psychological paper that intuition is, because many people will say, I edit intuitively, I would say the same thing, but that it's born from deep knowledge of your job and an understanding of patterns that you see, and like your intuition of knowing, oh, am I going to cut to Josephine? It's because you're a human being that knows when someone is thinking about something and you want to see her. So I'm just challenging the idea of what is intuition? Where does it come from?
Well, I think some of it is experience. I would never undervalue experience. And just being very sensitive to life in general. Sensitivity and empathy are really important attributes to have for an editor. That's a very philosophical question that I'm not sure. If I can figure out what the rhythm of a scene is, then I feel I'm kind of halfway there. And it's not necessarily about having music in a scene. And it could be that it's punctuated by some external sound that might be not even part of the scene itself. It might be something from outside of the window or something. Rhythm and just being empathetic to the characters, I think, is very important.
Yeah, for me, empathy is the number one skill. By the way, Claire's level of experience is an incredible thing. So I defer to her always with this stuff, and she was always spot on selections of choices of character moments and stuff. And it really just comes from knowing people, I think, and knowing what's a truthful emotion that you're seeing on screen.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think authenticity is really important. Yeah.
You mentioned rhythm, and the scene following the divorce scene where they're kind of alone in a bedroom or something is followed by the public divorce. And those two have very different rhythms. The private moment has one rhythm to it, and the public moment where all eyes are upon them has a very different rhythm. Can you talk about building that? And shot size choice was one of the things that I noticed, when to be on a wide shot.
Well, it's interesting about when do you use a wide shot, when do you go in close? It's always that kind of internal tussle you have. When is it important to go in close? And sometimes just using a wide shot can say it all, really, because you want to have a sense of the room. You want to have a sense of the other people and their reactions. And you don't want to go close on people's reactions. A body language is very important. And so, you know, when you've got an intimate dinner scene, it's easier to be in close. But when you're in a public setting and you're declaring something, then it's much more useful to be in wide shots, because it suddenly becomes from the personal to the impersonal, from the intimate to the public. And it's all trial and error, really. It's all kind of testing how these things play.
Yeah, and I would say it goes back to also just classical film editing in some cases, where the scene before the divorce with the two of them at dinner, we start with a wide two shot just to kind of establish the distance between these two people at the table. And then there's this burning fire between them before we move into the closer stuff. And then for the divorce itself, using the wide shot up front kind of highlights the kind of insanity of this moment. Like it's not a wedding, it's the exact opposite of this thing. And they're having to read speeches together, and it's a very, very awkward thing. She is trying to hold her emotions in, but they get the best of her at a certain moment. And using the wide shots just kind of highlight how like sad and tragic this whole thing is. So trial and error and the intuition of where the character was going to be in that moment.
I think there was also a wide shot kind of in the middle or near the end. There was like movement where you needed to see what was happening. I felt like, oh, of course you're going to be on a wide because you need to see the geography of the scene at that point in the scene.
I think also what's interesting is at some point to create a little shock in the scene, to maybe just suddenly pull out wide, or the reverse, you know, suddenly jump cut close. It's all about reminding the audience that they have to pay attention. So I really like to do these little shocks in the scene to help orientate people and, you know, grab their attention.
Yeah, and I also think with an actor like Vanessa, it's more than just the acting on the face and the words. She has a real delicacy with the way that she moves her arms and her hands. And in some of those wider shots with her hand, like on the divorce letter and stuff, you read her uncomfortableness in that moment. And staying on a wider shot like that made you realize just how awkward the whole thing is. So
there is a scene where Napoleon's first child is presented to Josephine after they've been divorced, so they're not living together. And Napoleon brings this child to her. I love the construction of that scene. Can you talk to me about the shot choices? It's not that long of a scene. It's six or seven shots, maybe less than that.
So that's a really controversial scene, actually.
Okay.
And it's really interesting.
I loved it. It almost felt like a horror movie to me.
So that was the ultimate hope for it. Because when you think about this, what an insane thing. This guy is bringing the baby to Josephine. It's actually quite a cruel thing. And that, like, if you were Josephine, like, there's part of you that might just want to throw the baby in the lake. Because, what an awful thing to do. And so the question was, do we need this scene? Do we not need this scene? And there were a lot of different feelings on it. And ultimately, I know with Ridley, he loved the emotion that was getting played in that, because again, Vanessa barely has to say anything in that scene. However, her facial reactions when she turns away at the beginning, once she realizes what's about to happen, is a really expressive moment for her, where you do get a sense that this is a horrible thing. Why is this happening? But then she kind of accepts it as we believe Napoleon's intention of it was, because Napoleon doesn't think he's being mean. He thinks he's just like, oh, look, this baby I've brought you. We trimmed that scene down to the barest amount of shots needed. The scene just says it all, just what it is, where he's bringing this baby to her, and then she just has to kind of accept that this is what her life has become. And that's why the line of one day you'll understand what I have sacrificed for you, it works because of that.
Honestly, that's one of the scenes that's going to stick with me from the film. Music in some of the film is very unusual. What did you temp with?
We had a composer, Martin Phipps, who I think did an excellent job. Some of his score is just outstanding and very unusual. Then we did have a kind of clue at the beginning. Ridley mentioned that we should watch Barry Lyndon. And he was sort of fascinated by Barry Lyndon, as am I, actually. It's one of my favorite films. He uses music in a really interesting way. He uses a lot of classical music. It underscores the satire of the film as well. I think that some of the music we use also underscores the satire. And also some of the humor, when you've got a humorous scene and you're playing a very straight piece of music, it seems to make it funnier in a way. We used a lot of classical music. Sam and I are both obsessive music people. We had a great music supervisor, Kathleen Wallfish, who brought in a lot of period stuff. And we have a wonderful music editor, Tony Lewis. Tony's wonderful at weaving things together, and that was very helpful. It was Ridley's idea to use the Corsican music because, of course, Napoleon was Corsican, and he wanted to have this sort of rough edges of that music, the peasant choir, or at least the choir singing peasant music, should I say. Ridley had some very interesting ideas about music. The composer was very gracious. He picked up on them and ran with them. And I thought he did a sterling job.
So Martin gave us his whole kind of catalog of music to temp from. So we had the variety of things that he's done before, and that was very helpful to find the tone. But what I was going to say about our music editor, Tony Lewis, he had to temp Waterloo, and Waterloo is a beast. It's a long sequence. Like, it ended up being like 15 or 16 minutes, and there's a lot of different moments in it that would have been hard to temp from just like one source. Yeah. And Tony made it happen where from a variety of different sources, some Martin, some others, and just kind of created the tapestry of this thing. And so once we presented that to Ridley, he was like, yes, this is the emotion that I want for this grand, grand battle at the end of the film. Martin took that and ran with it and gave us something that we thought was really, really special for that battle.
Yeah. There was also one point in the Battle of Waterloo where it was really a complicated, dramatic transition. And it was really musically difficult to achieve that. Ridley, his idea was to bring in the choir at that point, and it just transformed the whole thing. It was amazing, actually. Very impressive.
And then we also had the both sides of the battle, the French and the British, had their guys playing drums as well, that we were having to make work with the overall musical feel of the whole thing. It's a feat of music editorial that this works. And our fantastic re-recording mixer, Paul Massey, who does specifically the dialogue and the music, that all worked for that moment.
Paul specializes in music as well. He was a music mixer originally. He was just loving it. Loving the challenge.
Even if you don't know anything about history, you have to know that Waterloo is Napoleon's Waterloo. You've got to know that he's going to be defeated. How did you build the tension? The tension, I thought, was marvelous. Like, you know what's going to happen, but when and how and why and what's going to happen? The tension was great.
Oof, that's a good question. Strategy-wise, okay, this thing happens, and this thing happens, and this thing, and that thing. So we had kind of a blueprint of how we were going to get A to B. Martin did a really great piece of music for us at the beginning of that scene that set the tone, established, here comes a battle scene with Wellington. As the scene got a little bit more chaotic, because it's basically Napoleon is just waiting too long to act, and that was his ultimate downfall, we wanted to make it seem a little threatening. And so the tone and the music changes a little bit as well. And once the cannon firing and all of that happens, we go kind of pure effects for a little while in the battle. And it's just an assault on your senses because the cannons are so huge and the volume of people being like murdered on this battlefield is just an overwhelming thing. That really kept it going on. And then once you get to the moment where like all of the charging is happening, we have all of the horses coming down while the infantry is going on both sides. It's just a testament to Ridley's genius of shot construction. When I was putting the thing together, we'd look at dailies in kind of the 9-bank Avid screen. And I'd be like, oh, okay, well, at this moment, wow, it'd be really great to have a wide profile tracking shot of the horses charging down the hill. Well, guess what? That's what Ridley Scott gives you. So like all 9 choices are this insane embarrassment of riches. And so it just allowed us to find the exact right size and exact place to be at every moment in that scene to keep the audience engaged with the foreknowledge, because everyone knows he's not going to win this battle. So you just have to have it be this impending sense of dread that builds throughout the sequence.
Also, what Sam mentioned about the drumming, it's not one steady drumming throughout. The English have their set of drummers. The French have their set of drummers, and they're all in different rhythms. And that gives you, when you cut from one to the other, it gives you this kind of weird sense of dislocation that helps build the tension. Whereas if you had one drum beat going on all the way through, it would be very, very monotonous.
In the middle of that Waterloo, there's a big cut to Joachim. Yeah. Talking about making that choice and knowing that that was coming at the right moment.
Claire was talking about it earlier. That's when we introduced the Corsican thing back to him, because that centered it on Napoleon in that moment. At this point, he's going to lose. Then we get real close with him and follow him out to the thing where it's just like a march to the death. That was a really strong thing when Ridley was like, no, this is where we're going to do this. And it really transformed the second half of that scene.
Claire, you've worked with Ridley before, or both of you have. How did that relationship start?
Oh, that was a long time ago. I'd cut a film for Oliver Stone called Salvador. Ridley saw it. I was working on Platoon at the time, and he called me up and said he'd just seen it and he'd love to meet me. And so I worked on Someone to Watch Over Me, which was a smallish film, but it's a very tender film. We got on very, very well. He asked me to, you know, do other films with him, but we got out of sync. I went on after Someone to Watch Over Me. I was scheduled to do Wall Street. But we always kept in touch, in fact. Then one day, because I have a house in Italy, he called me up and said, I'm in Rome. Are you in Italy? And I said, yeah, I am, yeah. He said, come down and have dinner with me. So, you know, went down and we chatted, reminisced about old times. And he said, you know, I'm here scouting something. Are you interested? And I said, send me the script. Anyway, I always enjoyed working with Ridley. So actually, it wasn't really even a question of reading the script. I said, yeah, sure, I'm free.
If Ridley asked me about that, I would not ask to see the script. I'd probably say, yeah, okay. Sam, you've worked on multiple films for Ridley and kind of worked your way up through the ranks. How has that worked for you?
Yeah, so I've been a longtime assistant editor on the big movies, and then I'd worked as an editor on a lot of independent films. I've been very fortunate throughout my career to get to work with a lot of truly great editors. And for a time, I was working with Joe Hutching, who worked with Claire on Wall Street. And I had just a fabulous time working with him for a couple of years. He was leaning towards retirement after we'd worked on a show. When I told him that I'd saw this availability to be a first assistant for Claire and for Ridley on Raised by Wolves going to South Africa, he was like, oh, take it. 100%. Go work with Claire. And it's Ridley Scott, man. Just do it. You're going to have an absolute blast. I met Claire at the airport in Cape Town. Like, we had interviewed over the phone, but we hadn't actually met each other in person. And we hit it off right away over our shared love of tennis and movies and wine and good food and all of this stuff. And it was a fabulous collaboration from the jump on Raised by Wolves. And she's very giving and very supportive. And she gave me an option to, like, you know, edit a few scenes early on that show. And she liked what I did and really liked what I did, and it just blossomed from there. So that on both Last Duel and House of Gucci, the kind of creative collaboration just expanded to the point where I mean, I still can't believe that she asked me to edit Napoleon with her. Like, this is, like, you know, dream come true. It's an incredible partnership. So the last 5 years have been kind of a whirlwind for me, starting from being a first assistant to now, you know, taking on a project of this size.
Sam is wonderfully gifted, and he's a very, very talented editor. I was lucky to meet him. It works both ways.
And now you're rolling right into Gladiator 2. Are you both on that now, or is that what you're working on?
The emails are coming fast and furious, man. And the dailies.
What's the value of having that extra set of eyes for each of you, and how do you collaborate with each other, and how do you collaborate with Ridley together?
I think it's wonderful being able to have a co-worker looking at the stuff one has done, you know, because editing is such a solitary occupation. To have the benefit of a talented storyteller before it actually goes to the director, and to have that kind of input, is invaluable. It's been an absolute gift, I think, for these very big movies with lots and lots of footage and with such broad scope. I mean, I think it would take twice as long for one person to do the work. And it just gives a freshness. I mean, we have a good time. In the morning, we start off with, you know, coffee, talking about the latest tennis matches and politics. We're very into politics. So we go through the papers and check each other's opinion on such and such. And then we go into our rooms and start our own solitary work, and then at the end of the day we get together and or at lunch or whatever, and sometimes we just sit in the same room and work out a cut together. You know, once we get the film in some kind of shape, we often just sit down together and just chew the fat, as it were.
It's been incumbent on us to be up to camera because the breakneck pace of the production, then the only way that's possible is two editors, simply. Thankfully, I'm working next to Claire Simpson, one of the best ever. And so like her first edits are like a lot of editors' fourth or fifth edits. So I got to play it like that level, which is a challenge that I welcome. During the dailies process, we would sit and once our fabulous assistants, by the way, led by first assistant Danielle El-Hindi, have a serious job on their hands with the amount of cameras and the amount of speed changes and whatnot with what's photographed, that they do all of the grouping and the syncing and get everything in 24 frames for us to be able to just view it before to say we're even cutting it. And so the two of us will sit there and watch the previous day's dailies and then just like, all right, what scene do you want? What scene do you want? And then we go our separate ways for a while and then trade our cuts and give feedback to each other. And then a great thing about Ridley Scott is how respectful of editing he is. So during the shoot, he will come and see us usually on Saturdays, and we're a total respite for him from the madness of being on production. And so it's a way more relaxed thing when he's with us. One of his mantras is always, don't show me till you're ready, because he respects the process so much. So he's letting us put the movie together and putting our spin on his vision of it. And then he'll come in and the three of us will watch a short chunk or the whole thing. And he just loves fresh out of the box ideas for where the film should go at a certain point. So it's been a fabulous collaboration.
Some directors want to use two editors and kind of split them up and I'll work with you and then you send you off and then I'll jump in with the other person. He prefers that the three of you work together, it sounds like.
Absolutely. It just works better that way. I think there's no sense in our cutting room setup of hierarchy. We all work symbiotically from, you know, the runner to Sam and myself. Everybody has a huge contribution. I can't give enough praise to the assistants and our visual effects people and Michael Chung, visual effects editor. He works alongside us. He's part of our team and we don't have this sense of separation. Oh, it's visual effects over there. Oh, it's music over there. You know, we all work together and we all appreciate each other and what contributions each individual brings. And that's the way it works. And it works well.
Claire and Sam, thank you so much for spending some time with us and telling us about this great film. Fantastic job. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Steve. It's really nice to meet you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Claire Simpson, ACE, and Sam Restivo for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.